Always love the camping theme. I smiled back, handed both of them sticks, and laid out the marshmallows and wieners. I put a lot of effort into getting the campground just right. Evenings around the campfire had been one of the highlights of my summers when my dad would take us out to the cabin. Even as a child, I had felt the spirituality and timeless zen of sitting around the fire with the trees looming in the semi-darkness. This fire had just enough poplar in it to cause the occasional pop, but not so much that it began to sound like gunfire. I'd edited out insects. We Bobs tend to be a little obsessive about realistic detail, but come on, who needs mosquitoes? Once everyone was properly set up and ruining perfectly good marshmallows, I started the meeting. One of our hunting parties ran into a dozen raptors today. They'd set up an ambush, and a pretty good one. I had to busterize one of them, or we'd be down another settler. Bill shrugged. I've said it before. I know it looks like really intelligent behavior, but pack predators on Earth did that kind of thing all the time. It's easily explained by instinct. Get Jurassic Park out of your mind. Bob was grinning at me, so I just smiled and nodded. Yeah, okay, point taken. Anyway, Bob's automated surveillance system should be pretty valuable once we get it set up, especially with Bob's new and improved ordnance. Guppy ran the surveillance system on Eden for years, Bob said. It'll be interesting to wire up a dedicated Guppy to handle the job, though. No replicant oversight. You sure about that, Howard? Not entirely, I admitted. But I wouldn't dare suggest using up resources to build Bob's just for running guard details, you know? Bill and Bob said in perfect unison, Butterworth would have a cow. We all broke up in laughter. With certain notable exceptions, the Bobs all had similar senses of humor. What tickled one funny bone tickled all. There were a few milliseconds of contemplative silence. I looked at Bob. How's it going with the Deltons? Bob smiled a sad smile and shrugged. Archimedes has a growing family now. Time marches on. People age, you know? It's starting to freak me out a little. I'm watching people I know live their lives, getting older. Bill and I both nodded. Immortality had sounded like a great idea back on Earth, but there were costs, especially when you became attached to ephemerals. I glanced quickly at Bill as I had that thought. I knew Bill was touchy about the use of that term, but no, he couldn't read my mind. I hoped I didn't have a guilty expression. Probably a good time to change the subject. We're ahead of schedule overall. We'll probably be finished decanting the settlers from Exodus 3 this week. Riker will be happy to get back in touch with our relatives. Bill and Bob both nodded. Bob said, I enjoy watching the exchanges, but I have to admit that it would be too painful for me to talk to them. I'm glad Riker is up for it. I keep seeing the resemblance to my sisters in people's faces, and it's gut-wrenching. I smiled slightly. I don't think anyone had ever come out and said it to him, but the common feeling was that Bob, one, had gotten an extra dose of original Bob's anxiety. He tended to get wound up about stuff like that. I said to Bill, before I forget, I need to contact Riker. I want to find out if he can locate some oak and scan it for me. Oak? Bill raised an eyebrow at me. If Riker can get a good enough scan, I should be able to print some real oak barrels. It'll take forever to print something biological, you know? I know, Bill. It's more a proof of concept at this stage. I'll have a printer doing nothing but making staves until I have enough. Bill looked confused for a moment, then grinned. Going into business? No, just doing my part to maintain morale. We talked for a few more milliseconds about miscellaneous items, then they signed off. And Guppy popped in with my next to-do. Oh, that one. I'd been putting that off. Butterworth was livid. This was no mere cow he was having, this was the whole herd. I listened, jaw agape, as he carpet-bombed his tirade with expletives. I hadn't even been aware he knew the F-word. Turned out he was an expert in its use as a verb, noun, adjective, adverb, article, and several forms of punctuation. I made sure I was recording. Finally, he calmed down. Relatively. Sort of.
So, these others. Moronic name, by the way. Are going around depopulating planets just because?
Well, according to Mario, I noted that Butterworth couldn't quite suppress an eye roll. He didn't think much of our naming choices. They kill all the life on any planets in the system, then extract all the metals and rare elements.
And we are parked out here like a juicy target.
I looked down and took the time to rein in my tendency to sarcasm before answering. Colonel, it's not like you'd have been any safer on Earth. If anything, Vulcan is slightly farther away from where they appear to be operating. And Earth has been advertising its presence for a couple of centuries with radio pollution. The colonel nodded, closed his eyes, and took a deep breath. I felt for him. He had no doubt thought that the worst was over with the landing on Vulcan. Now we were all back in the frying pan.
So, what plans do the Bobs have, Howard?
Now I was on more neutral ground.
Mario has built a bunch of scout Bobs, and they're checking nearby systems. He's going to keep building cohorts, and they're going to keep spreading out until they've mapped the others' depredations.
Then we'll take it from there. Bill has turned his attention to methods of destruction. Unfortunately, the others are probably ahead of us technologically. We have some bootstrapping to do.
Keep me informed, please.
He wandered over and sat at his desk, rubbing his forehead. I enjoyed the few seconds of silence as he reviewed his notes.
Farm donuts,
he said, looking up at me.
Those appear to be exceeding expectations.
Yes, Colonel. Bill came up with a lot of engineering improvements while breeding up the plant stock for release on Ragnarok. He has something called free time? I hope to experience it someday. Butterworth snorted and gave me a wry smile. We were both going full bore getting the colony up and running. The fact that replicants didn't need to eat or sleep just meant that I was available 7 days a week, 22 hours and 13 minutes a day. Or 31:49 on Romulus. Scheduling was going to be a headache once the Romulan colony was up and running. Funny, I couldn't remember any science fiction stories that actually dealt with how you'd handle timekeeping on a new planet.
And that means, Butterworth continued, that we'll be able to set up the Spitz and Faith colonies on an accelerated schedule. I expect you're looking forward to your descendants coming out of stasis.
No one more than Riker, I grinned. I have to admit it's been a pretty popular program in Bobnet. Butterworth grimaced.
Bobnet? 7 billion people on Earth in the early 21st century, and Faith decided to replicate a nerd-slash-engineer with a Star Trek fixation.
He grinned at me to take the sting out of the comment and reached for the disconnect button.
Until tomorrow, then.
17. We've lost a drone. Bob. May 2171, Delta Eridani. The conversation with Bill had been both awesome and depressing. The idea that humanity was down to 15 million people was devastating. On the other hand, it sounded like that number had come close to dropping to a big fat zero. On the plus side, I wasn't surprised that he'd cracked the subspace problem, but I was impressed by how quickly he'd done it. It left a small, nagging question in the back of my mind as to whether I could have pulled that off. How different from me was Bill? No matter. The problem had been solved. Bill and I were working on merging the VR source from our two independent development branches, and real-time communications between Bobs was now a reality, at least in principle. I grinned to myself at the idea of a galactic internet. There still weren't a lot of Bobs online, but that would change as Bill's message spread through the local sphere at the speed of light. I was overjoyed to find out that I had the official first contact position sewn up. But I doubted I would be the only one. Luke and Bender hadn't come online yet. I hoped they would eventually intercept Bill's transmissions so we could get caught up. Just in case, I instructed the local space station to periodically retransmit the Scut plans along their flight paths. One way or another, they'd eventually receive the plans. The lack of significant progress on Bill's Android project was a little disappointing. A lot of the basic tech was being developed back on Earth when original Bob was still alive, but it was proving difficult to put all the concepts together into an artificial body that could operate like a complete organism. Oh well, sooner or later, Bill would make some breakthroughs. Meanwhile, I had my own projects. Marvin had taken delivery of the exploration squads and was deploying them into his search grid, covering the Deltan's original territory. At the level of detail we were trying for, he expected to be finished in 3 months or so. I just lost a drone. Marvin popped into my VR unannounced. He had a perplexed expression on his face. Define lost. Have a look. He popped up a video window. It showed a panoramic view of Eden from several hundred meters in the air. The drone was flying a search pattern, looking for clearings that could be potential former villages. Suddenly, the image began corkscrewing wildly and breaking up. After about half a second of this, the image disappeared. The hell? I muttered. I'm assuming that was an attack from above. It would appear so. I did a frame-by-frame, and this was the best I could come up with. He popped up a still image. It was out of focus and broken up by video interference lines, but there was an impression of something biting or chewing on the drone. I ran some filters and cleanup routines on it. The result is partly extrapolated. He switched to a second image. This one was still grainy and lacking in detail, but I could make out what appeared to be a large beak or muzzle filled with teeth. Wow, I said. I would sure hate for that to be the last thing I saw. Guppy, are we getting any telemetry at all from the drone? Marvin asked.
Negative. Attack likely took out the power system.
Well, I want to take a look at the wreckage. I'll set up a SADAR search. Highly refined metal should stand out like a lamp in a cave. Marvin stood up, gave me a salute, and disappeared. The wreckage of the drone rotated slowly in the holotank. Marvin had found the destroyed unit several kilometers south of its last known location and had taken a full detail SADAR scan. The drone was bitten almost in half and had two parallel claw marks dug into the shell. The units were designed to be lightweight. Unlike the busters, there was no armor. Still, anything that could dent metal like that had to be dangerous. And whatever it was airborne. Scary. Then there's this. Marvin popped up a couple of images. One was a close-up of the damage to the drone, and the other was a close-up of some bones. Interesting. I reached out and pointed to a spot on the picture. That looks a lot like the bite impression on the drone. Yeah. I've got a number of similar examples. Whatever this is, it used a snack on Deltans. Could that be why the Deltans migrated out of their original area? My eyes got wide at the thought. They weren't moving to a more dangerous territory. The gorilloids were the lesser evil. Or they didn't know or care about the gorilloids. Marvin's voice was hushed. Then the gorilloids chased them over the mountain range to the location where we found them. We sat in silence for several milliseconds. Marvin finally broke the silence. I still don't have enough information to narrow the search. Well, we know they're big enough to eat a Deltan or pull a drone out of the sky. I did not like this. Not a bit. 18. It's getting worse. Riker, September 2172, Sol. A crowd stood outside the police lines. Hopeless faces, some crying, parents holding children by the hand, couples holding each other, wearing stricken looks. People who would be better off almost anywhere but here. 63 confirmed dead so far. The apartment building, a rundown six-floor concrete structure with no balconies, now had a huge bite taken out of it at ground level. That it would have to be condemned was a given. I was more worried that it might fall over at any moment, crushing everything nearby. This wasn't a great neighborhood. By almost any pre-war standards, it would be a slum. Buildings all had their own power systems since the invention of dependable fusion, but the streets were dirty, unlit, and covered with graffiti. Windows and doors at ground level had long since been reinforced or completely covered over. Stains ran down the sides of the structures from weather, deteriorating paint, and contributions from birds. The people living in this favela hadn't been significant in any way. They weren't government or military or anything that would justify making them a target. Just people. Probably unemployed, living on the edge of poverty. Most of them likely had no hope, no future, other than the possibility of eventual emigration to another star system. What was the point? What could possibly justify this? The perpetrators had attacked people with next to nothing and taken even that. Sometimes it shamed me to think that I used to be human. I accepted a call from the Brazilian minister. "This is the third attack this month, Riker, and there has been no progress in catching the perpetrators. What assurances can you give me that something will be done?" Minister Benedito looked more spooked than angry. Very probably he was worried about his job. Still, this wasn't the time to get my back up. "Minister, I'm not in charge of the investigation. Really, I'm not in charge of anything except the global emigration effort. I'm here as, well, a consultant. I will help out the investigation any way I can, but you have to look to your internal security forces to get this resolved. Plus whatever the UN can do, of course." I could see from Benedito's face that he didn't think much of my response, but it was all I had. I made mining drones available to the emergency personnel to help locate and extract bodies or survivors. I set up surveillance drones around the perimeter in case the terrorists tried to send in a follow-up attack, and I made sure that those in charge had a direct line to me. And mostly, I waited. This was, as the minister had said, the third attack this month. This was terrorism, pure and simple. And not even for any political end, as far as I could tell. There had been no announcements, no demands. Someone simply seemed to be out to get Brazil. Since Florianopolis was pretty much all that was left of the former empire, this was the natural target. 1,500 ships or 1,500 trips. The inexorable logic of mathematics mocked me. Minister Gerald, the representative from New Zealand, was holding forth again on my shortcomings, both real and imagined. He really hated me for some reason, and had since day one. Not that I cared, the man was a putz, but my orderly mind liked to have a link between cause and effect. Plus, if I was going to create this kind of reaction in someone, I would rather have an end game. Fighting some random idiot was a waste of energy. Today's rant was about the sabotage and our inability to deal with it. I let my public avatar display alert interest while I rolled my eyes in my VR. He finally ran down, and I prepared to offer a response, but the minister from the Maldives beat me to it. And beating a computer to the punch was an impressive feat. I wondered if I should do a systems check. The chair recognized Minister Sharma, and she stood up.
"I'd like to thank the minister for giving us a summary of his speech from last session, which, if I recall, was also a summary from a previous speech. I'd be even more appreciative if it had been a prelude to some new information, or at least witty. Minister Gerald, you've obviously got a problem with the replicants. I'd like to ask you to take it offline so we can get on with actual business."
The attention lights blinked rapidly, the remote meeting's equivalent of applause. Minister Gerald's face clouded up and he sat back, arms crossed. I made a note to send Sharma a thank you note. But she was right. He obviously had a pickle up his butt about replicants in general, and me in particular. The next item on the agenda concerned the deteriorating climate. Several enclaves in the higher latitudes were approaching non-viability. Two ships, Exodus 4 and Exodus 5, were due to launch this month. The UN had confirmed that the island nations would be sent to Poseidon. The question on the table was whether we needed to switch the order of emigration or whether we could just move the troubled enclaves into the vacated territories. Everyone had an opinion, and every opinion seemed to be different. I leaned back and looked around. I just realized that Homer wasn't here. He usually popped in to mock the UN meetings. I think I was starting to depend on his satirical take on things to get me through the tedium. Looked like I'd have to get through this one the old-fashioned way. I activated Sandbox Bob and handed off the video window. Freedom. 19. Pray. Bob, June 2172, Delta Eridani. Archimedes patiently tied two strands of vine together while the cub watched. I smiled, observing the tableau in the video window. His mate, Diana, kept one eye on the drone. She had never liked the drones, or me, and still tensed up when one was around. Having a child to protect just made her that much touchier. Archimedes was oblivious. He was too busy teaching his cub basic skills. The cub took the vines and, tongue sticking out of a corner of his mouth, tied a perfect granny knot. Archimedes sighed and corrected it into a square knot. The cub smiled up at his father, and I experienced a jolt of, well, something. Pride? Envy? Wistfulness? Maybe all of the above. It was hard to sort out. My eyes were watering, and I had to suppress a strong urge to re-watch one of the recordings of Riker's chats with our family. I minimized the window and turned to see Marvin watching me. He said nothing, and after a moment he dropped his eyes and went back to what he was working on. I took a few deep breaths and brought the window back up. The cub had successfully executed a square knot, although he still didn't seem to be clear on the difference. I chuckled. I'd given Archimedes some sailing knots over the last while, and he was learning them, one at a time. It looked like he was trying to pass that knowledge on to his cub. The boy would be given a naming ceremony as soon as he said his first word. Both Archimedes and I expected that to happen earlier than average. The Deltans quite reasonably considered language to be the difference between them and animals, and the first use of language was the proof that the child had, for want of a better word, a soul. The Deltan word didn't quite mean the same thing, but it was close enough. Diana was still eyeing me, so I decided to give her a break. I told Archimedes that I was going to go for a cruise around, then took off. I brought the drone up to a kilometer altitude and rotated slowly. It was still early in a beautiful spring day, and dew sparkled on the trees and grass. This part of Eden was mostly forest, but there were enough meadows and open areas to allow grazing animals to make a living. I was making a point of recording panoramas like this whenever I could. Someday, maybe 10,000 years in the future, the Deltans would be civilized and would probably have done something to Eden similar to what humans had done to Earth in the 20th century. It would be nice to be able to show them what their world had once been like. I wondered if I would still be hanging around here by then. Wow, I needed to shake off this melancholy mood. I enjoyed hanging with Archimedes, but once in a while it triggered images of my parents and sisters. When that happened, a change of scenery was in order. I instructed the drone to fly back to Camelot and take up station keeping, and I switched to a drone stationed at one of the LaGrange auto factories. The armaments project was overdue for inspection anyway. I had a section, carefully separated from everything else, where I was experimenting with explosives and munitions manufacture. I was playing with the idea of a shell powered by plastics instead of gunpowder. A primer triggered by an electrical current would remove the need for a hammer. Using ethylene glycol as the binder would result in a compound that was usable under all environmental conditions, including extreme cold. And the stuff didn't become unstable with age. Oh, and it was easier to work with safely than gunpowder. I moved on to the main auto factory area. Four replicant matrices were currently nearing completion to give life to the Version 3 Heaven vessels lined up nearby. I hadn't decided yet if I wanted to upgrade myself as well. Granted, the threes were significantly faster than my Version 2 hull, but I had no immediate need for speed. Everything in the Delta Eridani system was accessible by drone. I seldom had any need to fire up my surge drive. Come to think of it, I hadn't left orbit around Eden in years. Despite my ongoing reluctance to replicate, I felt a moral obligation to get more of me out into the universe. Besides the simple fact that more Bob's exploring meant more interesting revelations, There was the implied promise to Dr. Landers to perform the task that he'd resurrected me for. By extension, I had a responsibility to what was left of the human race. Riker was doing a magnificent job of getting them off planet. It was up to the rest of us to find places for them to go. My brooding was interrupted by a text from Marvin. "There's been an attack." I sent the drone back to station keeping and re-entered my VR. Marvin was waiting. "Gorilloids?" I asked, sitting down. "No. I think it might be our giant claw. A foraging party was out gathering food when one of them was grabbed. They say they couldn't really see it, except they got the impression it was really big. It flew away with the victim, and everyone else hightailed it back to Camelot." "What do you mean they couldn't really see it? Did it jump out of a tree?" No, that's the thing. They were looking right at it, but couldn't make it out. The Deltans didn't really have a word for it, and the translation routine was having fits, then finally settled on invisible.
Ah, jeez. So a giant flying thing that can become fully or partly invisible, or maybe blend in.
I trailed off as I watched Marvin's eyes get bigger. He flipped through the archives and pulled up a video segment from my early investigation of Eden, back before I'd even found the Deltans. The video depicted what I'd named a hippogriff, about the size of a robin. This little critter had four legs and a set of wings. It was predatory, and it could hide in plain sight because it could change its coloration to match the environment. Oh, crap! They'd be a lot bigger than this little guy, but what the Deltans sort of saw would fit the bill. I nodded at Marvin. "Good catch, but we still don't know where it comes from, right?" Marvin shook his head. "I'm still searching outward from Camelot. I've reached the ocean in one direction, but still lots of land left at the other compass points. I'm biasing it towards the original Deltan territory, although that's not a sure thing either." "The big question," I said slowly, "is whether any of our drones saw it." "I already checked. There weren't any in the area. Everything we could spare is out searching. Somehow, this thing snuck inside our perimeter."
"Wonderful.
Wonder-freaking-full. I haven't just brought the Deltans back to the fire. I've put them back in the frying pan. Some sky god." I watched from a distance as the tribal elders gathered to discuss the recent death. I wasn't invited to attend, since I was probably the subject under discussion, and I didn't feel like forcing the issue. Archimedes was told to be there, and he looked nervous enough for both of us. He and Diana exchanged frightened looks before he left. The meeting went on for quite a while, and there was a lot of gesticulating and yelling. I'd probably never mentioned directional microphones to the Deltans, so I guess I couldn't blame them for not realizing that I could hear everything. Archimedes passed on my theories, which in retrospect probably made things worse. But it would have come out sooner or later. The central theme of the meeting, though, revolved around whether I was malicious or just an idiot. Either way, a lot of people believed that they'd been safer back at the old site. Objectively, that wasn't true. They'd been slowly going extinct and wouldn't have lasted more than another generation or so. But explaining population trends to essentially innumerate people was a losing game. They understood death when it happened in front of them, far better than they understood attrition. The meeting took about 2 hours. When Archimedes came back to his spot, he looked very hangdog. He sat down and accepted a piece of jerky from Diana.
"They're about evenly split," he explained. "Half think you've led us here to be food for the flying things. The other half ask how you could have known about these things if we didn't know, and we're from here."
I thought about that and sighed. If the Deltans had been human, those would have been the two camps, but the split wouldn't have been 50-50. Deltans were surprisingly rational. "You're not in trouble, are you?"
"Not really."
Archimedes glanced at Diana and smiled ruefully.
"But my, stock is down. I think that's how you say it.
Don't worry about it, Archimedes. You're still the best damned weapon maker in, well, anywhere. If you need to distance yourself from me for a while, that's fine. But either way, Marvin and I will continue to look for the hippogriffs. Archimedes nodded. His cub toddled up and dropped into his lap, head first.
Well, that explains it, Marvin said. I stopped at the shoreline, and I shouldn't have. The things seem to be centered on a rookery out on this island.
Marvin pointed to a large island a kilometer or two offshore, obviously volcanic in origin. It was steep, deeply folded, and very probably had a lot of lava tubes that would make perfect homes for large, flying things.
How many of them are there?
Can't tell for sure, Marvin shrugged.
They're always coming and going during the day, but unless I start tagging them, I don't know how many nests or dens or whatever are in those caves. But certainly scores of adults, at minimum.
I frowned. That's a significant population of predators, so what do they eat when they can't get Delton?
Marvin waved up a picture.
Seals. Well, seal equivalents.
Or maybe closer to walruses. They seem to fill the same niche. They spend most of their downtime basking on the beach, and they hunt in the water. They're a little more mobile than seals or sea lions, but still basically sitting ducks on land. Although I'd imagine they could do some damage with those tusks.
I stared at the picture for a few milliseconds, rubbing my chin.
I turned to the globe and expanded it until it showed just the island and the Deltons' past and current range.
So the hippogriffs discovered the Deltons, who were probably easier prey, chased them out of their original territory, Marvin continued the thought,
then eventually caught up with them after they moved into gorilloid territory. The Deltons could handle the gorilloids with flint weapons to help, but they couldn't handle both predators. They retreated over the mountain range, which put them out of range of the hippogriffs but lost them the flint resource. Without that, they couldn't quite hold their own against the gorilloids. I finished.
And then we, and by we I mean you, led them back to the flint site, where they are, once again, on the menu.
Marvin gazed at me with one eyebrow raised.
So, what now?
I sat down, called up coffee, and leaned back in thought.
I think we can agree that just doing nothing is off the table.
Marvin nodded, and I continued.
Likewise, asking the Deltons to move again is probably a non-starter. I doubt they'd do it even if I had a good, safe destination in mind. Plus, the flint site really is their best long-term bet, generally speaking.
Approaching predator detected.
We both looked up at Guppy's announcement. We'd used all available drones to set up a tighter perimeter around Camelot and set them to looking specifically for anything large and airborne. It appeared we had a bite. I pulled up the video that Guppy offered. The hippogriff was hard to make out. On a clear day, it would have been almost impossible to see. The blue of its hide matched the sky so well. But today there were too many scattered clouds for the animal to camouflage itself from all angles. It was heading directly for Camelot. There was no doubt in my mind of its intentions, and this was almost certainly the one that had taken the Delton 2 weeks ago.
Right, let's busterize it. I called up a buster and set it to full acceleration. It shot towards the hippogriff.
At the very last moment, though, the hippogriff dodged the bullet. Literally. This thing's speed and aerial agility was unbelievable.
We both stared for a few milliseconds, then I called up more busters.
Don't overdo it, Marvin cautioned. Let's find out what the animal is capable of.
We know we can get it if we throw enough busters at it. Let's find out what enough means.
I nodded at him and ordered most of my second wave to stand down. Instead, I sent in two busters in the fore-aft formation that Riker and I had used so successfully in the Battle of Seoul. Again, the hippogriff dodged the first buster. The speed of the animal was really impressive, but it was unable to correct for the second one. The splat created a cloud of fine red mist, which settled slowly to the forest below.
I didn't like that, Marvin said. We got it with the second one, but it was close.
I think if we want to take them out dependably, we should go with an encirclement using three or more busters. The question is whether this was a one-off, or whether they fly some kind of patrol pattern. Maybe there won't be any more coming this way. Marvin didn't look convinced. Predators almost always have a patrol pattern of some kind, if only to protect their territory from competitors. I doubt we've seen the last of them. It took less than a day to prove Marvin right.
Multiple incoming detected.
Oh, God, this just keeps getting worse. I pulled up the window and leaned forward. It was hard to tell from the returns, but it looked like about a dozen hippogriffs, give or take a few, were bearing down on Camelot. What the hell? Marvin said, popping in. What's attracting them? Just a guess, but I'd say the blood in the air yesterday from the busterized hippogriff. I'm sure a predator would be able to smell the spore for miles. Maybe it draws them like sharks. Okay, a dozen of them will require 36 busters. We don't have that available. We're going to have to wing it, Marv. They're in a fairly tight group. Maybe we can thin them out some of the first pass. Marvin nodded, and we called up the 20 busters that we had available. I ordered Guppy to fly in reinforcements from orbit, and we set the ones we had on a direct line of attack with maximum acceleration. By the time they neared the flock of hippogriffs, they were doing about Mach 1.5. The first pass took about 5 hippogriffs and allowed us to see that there had been 14 total. Now we had 15 busters left for 9 attackers. There was a good possibility one or two might reach Camelot. While the busters were coming around for another pass, I activated one of the drones in Camelot. I flew towards the first recognizable face I saw, which was Arnold. Everyone was looking in the direction of the sonic booms, staring at the red clouds that had appeared. I shouted at Arnold, "Hippogriffs coming! Get everyone under cover!" I shifted back to my VR without waiting to see if Arnold reacted. The busters were just coming in for the second pass, and Marvin had stacked them too deep. The leftover buster trailed the group, ready to take out a target of opportunity. The second pass took out 3 hippogriffs and injured the wing of a 4th. The clouds of red were now making it hard to see. Sudar was not particularly effective with biomass. Bodies showed up as dim ghosts, and infrared was having a lot of trouble with all the fresh blood floating around. The injured hippogriff lost altitude quickly, but it was a controlled descent. We probably couldn't depend on the impact killing it. We now had 11 busters. No, 9. 2 busters had collided and taken each other out, and 5 attackers left. It was going to be tight, unless they turned around and retreated. If they were anything like sharks with blood spore, though, that wasn't going to happen. The busters came around for a 3rd pass. There were fewer hippogriffs now, though, and they were spreading out, and the damn things really had quick reflexes. Despite buster pairing, we only took out 3 of the attackers. We were down to 6 busters and had 2 healthy and 1 injured hippogriff to deal with. Still, reasonable odds, except that they were now close enough to Camelot to present a real danger, and we didn't have the uninterrupted line anymore for a supersonic approach. Switch to bludgeoning and harassment. Guppy, where are the reinforcements?
5 minutes out.
Not good enough. I checked the action in Camelot. The mesa didn't have much in the way of caves or any other kind of overhead protection. It was ideal for protection from a ground assault, not an air attack. The Deltans were streaming out of the village down the 2 available paths, but with the bottleneck, they couldn't get the whole tribe evacuated in time, and they would be sitting ducks until they reached the trees. We commenced low-speed bludgeoning of the hippogriffs. They were even better at dodging at this speed, but they couldn't really do anything else at the same time. We finally managed to bounce one off the head of a hippogriff. It went down immediately. The other hippogriff ignored the byplay and tried to take a pass at the Deltans on one of the paths, but the busters kept it too distracted and it passed overhead without completing the attack. Unfortunately, a couple of Deltans panicked and fell or leaped off the path. I could see them tumbling down the steep scree. The Deltan hunters laid into the unconscious hippogriff. It was my first opportunity to get a good feel for relative scale. If the Deltans were human-sized, then the hippogriffs were about the size of a Clydesdale with bat-like wings. The animals looked more reptilian than anything. Teeth and claws were disproportionately large, resulting in an impression of something built for nothing but killing. It took only a few seconds for the Deltan hunters to ensure that the animal wouldn't be waking up. The live hippogriff, though, was still a major threat, and I had no idea where the injured one had gotten to. The busters continued to harass the healthy hippogriff, and it apparently decided to reduce the defensive zone by landing. Well, not a bad strategy, really. Now the busters could only buzz it from above. As it landed, the hippogriff changed its coloration to match the ground and rocks, but no one was going to be fooled at this stage. The animal snapped at the busters as they came within range, and it managed to snag one. It looked as though this would turn into a process of attrition, until the Deltons brought in their A game. 20 to 30 spears flew at the animal in a solid cloud. Fast or not, the hippogriff simply couldn't dodge that amount of incoming. Within moments, it resembled a pincushion. The hippogriff screeched and snapped at the spears sticking out of it. Arnold grabbed another spear from someone, ran straight toward the hippogriff, and made an Olympic-caliber throw from point-blank range. The spear went right through the animal's neck, and it dropped instantly. There were cheers from the hunters. The jubilation lasted only a moment, however. Screams from the retreating tribespeople brought our attention back to the paths out of Camelot. The injured hippogriff had made its way up to the base of the scree, found one of the people who had fallen, and was eating him. I sent all my remaining busters straight at it, with no allowance for pulling up if they missed. Two impacted with enough force to kill the last animal. It was too late for the Deltan, though. The good news, if it could be called good, was that we'd only lost three Deltans. A fourth had a broken leg, and I was going to have a confrontation with the medicine woman if she didn't listen to me this time. I'd lost 18 of my 20 busters. 20 more made it down from orbit, too late to do any good. And once again I was pulling all my printers off of their assigned duties to make more busters. The Deltans had called another tribal council. For them, two councils in a month was akin to panic. This time I was invited. Or maybe summoned. I doubted it was to give me a medal. I had noticed that some people were giving Archimedes a bit of cold shoulder. They couldn't overdo it, of course. He and Moses were still the only source of shaped flint, and Moses wasn't moving around much these days. If I was to describe the attitude in human terms, it would be coldly formal. Since Archimedes hadn't done anything to deserve it, I had to conclude that it was guilt by association. Arnold was sitting in council now. After that display with the hippogriff, he was man of the hour. Hopefully that would mean at least one sympathetic voice. There was some discussion among themselves, then they called me over. I floated down to head height and waited.
"Are there any other surprises that you have for us?"
Hoffa said without preamble. That was a surprise to me, too. You'll remember that I asked why you'd left Camelot. Only Axler had an inkling, and he didn't remember enough to warn us.
"Just the same, by following your advice, we seem to get deeper and deeper into trouble."
"By following my advice? You've retaken a location that you can defend against gorilloids and that has flint for weapons. I know a lot of you have trouble following my explanation, but I maintain that in the old camp, your children would have been the last of the Deltans." I paused for dramatic effect before continuing. "As for the hippogriffs, they're a problem because they're a surprise. I'm going to find out more about them, then I'm going to remove them."
"I've noticed," Hoffa said, "that despite your talk, it's still we who do most of the fighting."
"Really? When was the last time a group of your hunters had to beat off a gorilloid attack? Did you hear the sonic booms? Two hands and four hippogriffs approached Camelot, but only three arrived." Hoffa's ears were straight back and his eyes were narrowed to slits. I was mishandling this, but I couldn't stop myself. I'd never been able to handle short-sighted stupidity.
"That's three more than would have arrived at our old camp."
In VR, Marvin and I rolled our eyes in sync. "I've already talked about that."
"Perhaps next time we should leave your Archimedes out as an offering for them."
I sent the drone straight up 10 feet.
"Don't ever threaten my family. Not ever."
As I finished saying the words, I realized that I'd turned the volume up. It had probably been painful to sensitive Deltan ears. The entire council was cringing, and possibly not just from the volume. I slowly lowered the drone back to head height. I mean it, Hoffa. I'll take care of the hippogriffs, and thanks to you, I figured out how. Hoffa looked confused and somewhat concerned.